24 homes and 3 businesses were destroyed by a tornado that ripped through Wessington Springs last night. The severe weather hit around 7:40 in the evening. Today, people in town are just beginning the extensive work of cleaning up after the EF2 tornado. SDPB's Keely Boltina traveled to Wessington Springs and spoke with city residents as their families assessed the damage and tackled the rubble that used to be their homes and property.
Melissa Mabia stands in tennis shoes, yoga pants, and a Wessington Springs sweatshirt at the scenic overlook high above her small town. From this vantage point, she sees lush green trees, a glistening blue swimming pool, and smashed cars at what used to be the local dealership. Wednesday night, when tornado sirens blew in Wessington Springs, Mabius made sure her 3 kids were wearing shoes and bicycle helmets. They hunkered down with their puppy beneath the stairs in the family's basement.
We asked when we knew it was getting closer, threw blankets on them. I went on top of them. My husband went on top of me, and we put kind of a mattress on the top of us and kind of rode it out just like that. And we did some loud praying when the tornado went through just to kind of try to keep the kids' minds off of the noise that was coming.
Mabia says her children are 4, 6, and 7. She says they could hear the wind and the sound of glass breaking. When the storm died down, the Mabiuses ventured upstairs and saw that the twister destroyed windows and wreaked structural havoc on their house.
Glass everywhere, plaster off. We had a car that flew. We had 3 huge trees in the front yard that are no longer. Part of our garage door is gone, a camper, a swing set. We're lucky, though.
In the aftermath of the tornado, Mabius is balancing her role as a mother with her duties as a public servant. Mabius is mayor of Wessington Springs, and she's been on the job about a month and a half. The leader of the town, population less than 1,000, is getting help from local law enforcement, volunteer first responders, and the Red Cross. South Dakota's governor has also assigned 172 National Guard members to Wessington Springs. 2 of those soldiers step on white tape blocking the road so an official's car can roll into the devastated parts of town. I'm sitting in the back of a pickup truck being driven through the worst part of Wessington Springs. There are trees that have fallen on top of homes, branches cracked everywhere, windows shattered out of cars and homes. There's debris everywhere.
Out to the edge of the porch here, on this side was an alcove with windows. On where the door is there, that was the laundry room, and over there was our bedroom.
Pat Behrens describes what her house used to look like. It's unrecognizable. Nothing like an alcove or laundry room exists on this property. She says the upstairs had 3 bedrooms. All the tornado left behind is a small fraction of roof and part of a bathroom. The living room and dining room are obvious, though, because the storm wrenched off all the exterior walls, so it's a straight shot from the street to the backyard. Even without walls, a fan still dangles from the ceiling. Behrens says she and her husband finished a complete remodel 1 year ago.
Oh, I was just devastated, you know, for the first 20 minutes, and then you get a grip on yourself, and it is what it is.
Behrens says this, surrounded by evidence that damage the tornado inflicted is personal and painful. Someone rescued a quilt her grandmother made from the mountains of debris. It sits on the floor, hanging off of a ledge that was once her living room. Behrens and her family are sifting through the wreckage to salvage important treasures.
We have found my dad's little ash urn. We found one of the bronzed baby shoes that all 4 of myself and my sisters wore when we were babies. Found John's cell phone.
We're looking for my grandma's ashes. We found my grandpa's ashes. Can't find my grandma's. The pictures and stuff like that, you know, it's really stuff that, you know, you can never redo or, you know, you can't buy. So, I mean, it's just, I guess it's basically that kind of stuff, the stuff you can't buy or replace.
A helicopter circles overhead as Will Behrens fidgets with the Diet Coke can he holds. He's Pat Behrens' son, and he lives a few blocks away. But he was here at his parents' house Wednesday night when the tornado decimated their property.
We watched it till it got real close, till I saw roofs coming up a few blocks away. And my mom was hollering at us to get in the basement, so me and my dad went down there. And the corner of the house kept lifting up so you could see out from the basement. And then you just heard a big crash. I assume that's when that side of the house took off. And I just hunkered down over my mom and we rode it out.
They survived unharmed, but most of the Barons' belongings are crushed. The house is splintered and fragile. The grass is barely visible for the stuff littered all over. A coffee table, a rug, clothes, baking dishes, quilts, lamps, wallboards, insulation, and stray branches. Mounding piles like those at the Barons' home are cloned all over Wessington Springs. A jumble of crushed building materials, personal items, and trash hijacks entire neighborhoods and spills into the streets. Mayor Melissa Mabius admits it's a mess.
Of course, there's tears and there's sadness, and but we're a community who can rely on each other. And everyone, I think the main thing everybody's taking away from this is we all have our lives. We all made it out safe. Things are things. Sometimes you don't really realize that until it hits you personally.
But now residents have to deal with those things that the tornado tried to take from them. All around town, families in sweaty T-shirts and dirty blue jeans sort through the rubble. It's their first step toward piecing their lives back together in the aftermath of a wicked storm. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Keely Boltina in Wessington Springs.
South Dakota is the largest producer of buffalo in the United States. The bison industry in the state is diverse. Buffalo ranchers employ a wide range of methods to manage, slaughter, and process the bison they raise. On today's feature story, SDPB's Charles Michael Ray takes a look at an approach by one company to commercially harvest buffalo right in the field and run them through a mobile processing plant inside a semi-trailer. Jerry Blanks spends his early mornings in a pickup truck, driving across some piece of South Dakota prairie in the pre-dawn light, looking for buffalo.
And then the sun comes up and all of a sudden they're just 200 yards away and there's buffalo. And they've come to see you. It's kind of cool.
Blanks manages a mobile processing truck as part of the Sustainable Harvest Alliance for the Wild Idea Buffalo Company. He has a .30-06 rifle nestled next to his truck seat. And there's a foam pad taped to his driver's side mirror where he can rest the rifle to take aim. In his ashtray, there's a pile of spent copper bullets, mushroomed out from impact. Blanks spots the herd and drives slowly in a tangent to the animals gathered in a rough circle.
I'm looking at size and something that's going to present a shot for me.
He says how you approach buffalo in these situations is very important. Blanks doesn't want to spook these animals.
They're actually in the herd situation, fairly docile, fairly approachable. It's just, you do have to know what you're doing, but you can get to them. You can get close, and as long as you ain't making them try to do something they don't want to, they'll let you do most anything.
It sounds like a cat in a way.
Kind of, yeah. Yeah.
I don't know.
As long as the cat wants you to pet him, he'll let you pet him. Yeah. And that's kind of like a buffalo. If they really didn't want to be here, they really wouldn't be here.
Blanks is not hunting these buffalo. Rather, he's harvesting. In the backseat of his pickup truck, there's a state meat inspector. His job is the same as it would be in any slaughterhouse. He's here to make sure the killing and processing of this buffalo fit all the strict health and safety standards. Blanks lines up on a male buffalo and moves the truck to a range of about 30 feet.
I'm aiming for the brain. You unplug that, and then everything else is the way it should be. We got to get them where they can't feel.
He points the rifle out the window, rests it on the driver's side mirror, and takes a careful aim. The buffalo drops in its tracks. It falls where it's hit, unconscious, to the ground. But Blanks doesn't move in right away.
I was just moving nice and slow. You can see the shot really didn't bother the rest of the herd that much.
The other buffalo slowly wander away. And it really does seem like they barely even notice the gunshot.
We took 9 yesterday out of this herd, and, it's kind of how you approach them, how you react after the shot, keep it calm, and, they'll just act naturally. They'll just do their thing.
Blanks hops out of the truck, ties the bison's legs up to a hoist, and raises the animal up over the back of the tailgate. He then drives back across the prairie about a half mile to the mobile processor. It's a semi-truck with a full setup in the back for turning a buffalo into meat. The state health inspector is here, and so is Blank's own son, Corey. The team loads the bison carcass into the back of the semi-truck and begins processing. The walls inside are clean and white. There's a sink and a tank of boiling water where knives are kept clean. Corey Blanks oversees the effort inside the truck.
We're, of course, dropping the hide off. We're looking for any dirt that might have come off as we were opening the carcass, bruises, anything like that that could be adulterating the carcass.
As the processing team works, Jerry Blanks heads back out into the field to collect another animal. By the time he returns, the team inside the truck will have this animal skinned and halved in the refrigerator. This truck is part of the Wild Idea Buffalo Company. Its founder, Dan O'Brien, doesn't knock other forms of bison management, but he says his company tries to keep bison stress-free and at home in their natural habitat.
You know, part of the value of buffalo is the iconic, mysterious value of it. I mean, it really is the national animal. They don't grow anywhere else except in the Great Plains of the United States, and we should be proud of that.
That iconic and mysterious image of the wild bison roaming free on the plains is part of the industry's marketing effort for buffalo meat. And in the case of the Sustainable Harvest Alliance and Wild Idea Buffalo Company, you get the feeling that that marketing actually matches reality. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Charles Michael Ray in Rapid City. Southeastern South Dakota communities are cleaning up after severe thunderstorms dumped rain and hail across the region. Some places received more than 8 inches of rain in just one day, and that's left many towns like Canton with serious damage. In this story, SDPB's Keely Boltina visits one of the hardest hit areas as residents try to dry out.
A rose-toned recliner rests crookedly in the entry to Racine Kimball's basement. A small plastic trash can floats next to it, the papers inside just visible through water tinged a silty brown. A lone, sparkly gold Christmas decoration barely bobs in the middle of the room. Kimball flips the light switch, but the basement stays dim.
Did you touch the switch, Art? Hey, how come the light doesn't work now?
While her husband finds the right breaker to bring electricity back to the lower level, Kimball talks about the items she stored in her finished basement. Most she planned to pass on to new owners in case the couple chooses to move to an apartment.
Oh, yeah, they were good. They were sellable. What's the noise?
Your treadmill? Your treadmill is going, dear. Yeah, your treadmill's on.
Oh, no. Oh, there it's off.
Permanently. The foot and a half of water calmly standing in Kimball's basement found more expensive victims. The fierce flooding tipped a white chest freezer onto its side. It's surrounding the water heater, and the electrical is iffy. When the severe weather drenched Canton, Kimball's sump pump and drain tile just couldn't keep up.
It just makes you sick because you think, now I had stuff stored down here. Those boxes back there was my daughter-in-law's mother's stuff. She had passed away, and she brought it down here for us to take to the thrift store. As you can see, it's all ruined. So that was devastating.
Kimball says she and her husband were powerless by 5 o'clock Monday evening. The water was too high. June rain turned Canton streets into rivers that afternoon and evening, and the water surged through Tuesday morning. Then the floodwater receded from the main portion of the roads. Small streams run in the low parts on either side of the street, and the water pools in some intersections. Now most of the flooding is hidden in people's homes.
I bet we've been here 3 hours or so, 3 or 4.
Dean Johnson is a volunteer firefighter, and he helps a crew pump several feet of water out of the Lutheran Church basement. They started with a fire truck and moved on to a portable pump.
Our hoses can only reach so far and still pull a draft. So the amount of hose, hard suction hose we got in there is the maximum we can have, and it won't reach all the way to where the boiler room is, so we brought our portable one in.
After bigger jobs like that, the 18-year fire department veteran says volunteers can help individual property owners.
There's people calling in with water in their basements, and we got a bunch of electric pumps that we can go and we can help the people out getting water out of the basement.
some nearby homeowners hope they can handle the flooding at their house on their own, but they aren't sure.
We have company.
Dustin Wallenberg introduces his wife, Roxy, and volunteers her to talk about what's happening in their home.
I'm manning the shop vac right now while my husband's ripping up carpet.
This room used to be a furnished spare bedroom in their Camden split level. Now a tack board border is all that's left of the carpet they had to cut out.
Salvage what we can. We had a couple beds in here and dressers, and hopefully they'll be okay, but we consider ourselves lucky that it's not worse. And that no one's living in the basement right now, so just kind of a spare room.
Floodwater saturated the home's lower level overnight.
The streets were flooding, but I kept checking down here and there wasn't a lot of water, so I figured it wouldn't be this extensive this morning, and we're kind of overwhelmed.
While Roxy Wallenberg returns to using the small wet-dry vacuum to suck up massive puddles, her husband Dustin wrenches wood paneling from the walls. He pries one piece apart from the studs and rips it off. He does this a second time and looks up. Mold. It's likely not from this water, but new flooding can make a mold problem worse. And it's not news the Wallenbergs welcome in the middle of this crisis. Just a few blocks away on the same street, Racine Kimball perches on the stairs leading to her flooded basement. She looks at the sunken possessions she planned to sell if she and her husband choose to downsize to an apartment after 26 years in this house.
Well, it made me decide that we're definitely going to go. But we'll get this all cleaned up, and we'll sell the house. And like I say, we'll manage somehow.
Several homeowners plucking soaked items from their flooded basements echo that same mentality. Someone's got it worse, and they'll figure it out. They say they just hope the clouds change alliances and the weather is on their side. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Keely Boltina in Canton.
At the Sturgis rally, anything goes. In one establishment in downtown Sturgis, a young woman is standing on a bar with a megaphone. She's wearing a bikini top and a pair of short cutoffs. For $25, bikers can drink liquor out of her belly button and lick whipped cream off her body.
It's what I would consider a hotbed for traffickers.
Dr. Elizabeth Talbot is a professor of social work at the University of South Dakota.
The very limited dress code that they have for women to be considered clothes really sets women up for exploitation.
Talbot has studied the issue of sex trafficking for about a decade. She's even spent time at the Sturgis rally.
All the men on all the bikes, of all the nudity that goes on at the rally, and it's an opportunity for traffickers to get their foot in the door in South Dakota.
Let's take a minute here to maybe clear up the difference between prostitution and sex trafficking. They are, you could say, separated by several shades of gray. The common notion is that in prostitution, a woman, or maybe a man, chooses to sell his or her own body. But
prostitution is no longer as we have stereotypically perceived it to be. Prostitution is now drug involvement and manipulation and taking advantage of young adults, young adolescents who are not mature enough to handle themselves.
Tattoos, piercing, hairbrush.
You can find an example of how a young woman could be lured into the underworld of sex trafficking right on the streets of the Sturgis rally.
Danny Stiles.
I'm Jackie Trinello. I'm 22.
20.
These two young women on Main Street Sturgis are wearing bikini bottoms and basically nothing on top but body paint and a few well-placed stickers. Their job is to hand out flyers and try to get passing bikers to come inside a nearby tattoo parlor. They can get tips whenever they pose with a biker for a photo.
We get a small, like, $200 for the 2 weeks, but most of our money comes from tips, yeah. Last year I did really well. I made about $1,500.
Trinello and Stiles hadn't heard that the day prior to this interview, there were several arrests made for sex trafficking right at the Sturgis rally.
I know things happen, but I didn't know that was going on. See, we don't go anywhere without a gentleman, without a guy, one of our guys with us. We don't go anywhere alone.
But those like Professor Elizabeth Talbot say these two are at high risk of falling into the hands of sex traffickers. Talbot adds that it's entirely possible that they may already be victims.
These traffickers come on, especially to young adolescents, as boyfriends or really nice guys. And before they know it, they're doing things like standing on a street corner, barely dressed, handing out flyers. And the next thing would be like, well, do you want to make a little bit more money? Well, you can do this, and you'll make a little bit more money. And then, well, how about this? And you can make even more money. And by the way, do you want some drugs? Pretty soon they're deep into being sold for sex. And it doesn't happen to everyone, but it happens to enough.
This year at the Sturgis rally, there were 9 men arrested for taking part in sex trafficking. South Dakota Attorney General Marty Jackley is among those backing the sting operation that netted the suspects.
It was somewhat of a wake-up call to South Dakota that we were able to run an operation whereby we were selling 12-year-old little girls, and we were having people bring money and certainly take steps in making that happen, and I think that's a concern anywhere.
Back at the bar in the middle of the Sturgis rally, one of the bikers has bought a body shot. He's going bald, with graying hair around his unshaven face. His beer belly is hanging out a bit below his T-shirt and leather jacket. The young woman lays down on the bar, and onlookers cheer while he sucks liquor off her belly and laps whipped cream off her torso. This is a common part of biker culture at Sturgis. But those like Talbot note it's not the culture of South Dakota.
Personally, I think they can have a rally, and a great rally, without exploiting women and children. And I think the people of Sturgis are just maybe not aware of how detrimental some of the behaviors that go on at the rally are to women and children.
South Dakota has received low rankings for its effort to combat sex trafficking from some national organizations. State and federal officials refute that the state is lacking in its effort to combat sex trafficking. The state legislature is due to look at a few laws dealing with the problem in the upcoming session. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Charles Michael Ray in Rapid City. About 75 supporters of gay rights gathered in Rapid City Thursday night to keep momentum going for equality in South Dakota. The event is a follow-up to a rally on February 17th that drew a large crowd to Rapid City's Main Street Square. Organizers told SDPB's Victoria Wicks that they'll continue to fight against bills such as those proposed in this year's legislative session that allow for discrimination against LGBT individuals.
The town hall meeting is held at St. Andrew's Episcopal Church, and one after another, gay people and supporters stand at the front of the room and give short speeches. Among them are Nancy Robron and Jenny Rosencrantz, who have said they're going to Minneapolis in April to get married, and then they'll sue the state of South Dakota for denying them the rights granted to other married people. David Patton compares the latest legislative attempt at denying gay rights to segregation laws that allowed businesses not to serve black people.
We outlawed Jim Crow a long time ago. You can't bring it back just by changing the subject line from black to gay. The United States is better than that, and the people of South Dakota are smarter than that.
Patton is a Rapid City attorney and president of the Black Hills Center for Equality. He says there was strong opposition to a House bill and a Senate bill that would have allowed business owners to deny services to gay people based on those owners' religious beliefs. He refers to a similar law that passed through the legislature in Arizona. Governor Jan Brewer vetoed that bill in the face of immediate backlash from large organizations, including the Super Bowl, who threatened to take their business to another state. Patton says if South Dakota had passed its proposed laws, it could have faced the same sanctions.
I think that Arizona gave the state a real wake-up call. I mean, here in western South Dakota, we really depend on tourist money, and we would have lost that money because people wouldn't have come to South Dakota. Boycotts were already forming. Jan Brewer is the furthest thing from a liberal. She's the furthest thing from gay-friendly. And even she knew that it was bad for her state.
Patton credits the majority of legislators for recognizing what he calls political theater and grandstanding.
I think that the wiser heads in peer, the good legislators, the people who do care about the state of South Dakota, saw that, and they defeated the bill before it even got out of committee.
The Center for Equality plans to assist Nancy Robron and Jenny Rosencrans to find an attorney and raise the funds to sue the state. And Patton says the group will continue to lead opposition to any future legislation that attempts to set aside the rights of gay people. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City.
Each of the three candidates for governor of South Dakota is highlighting why voters should choose him or her to lead the state. With less than 1 month until people go to the polls, gubernatorial hopefuls met on live television for a debate on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. The debate lasted 1 hour. This afternoon, SDPB's Keely Bultina breaks down the main topics candidates addressed.
The latest gubernatorial debate touched briefly on several statewide issues, but two primary topics dominated the discussion: education and health care. Democratic State Representative Susan Wismer says South Dakota should take advantage of the federal government's plan for states to expand Medicaid. Wismer says the move gives 48,000 South Dakotans primary health care, and more people can be productive workers when they find relief from chronic conditions.
These 48,000 people do not have access to preventive care, and that's the most efficient kind of care. They only have access to emergency rooms, and there, that is the most inefficient type of care. So if we did expand Medicaid, we would take a step toward allowing our health care system to provide services in a more efficient manner.
Wismer says the savings the state gains from comprehensively improving health care outweigh the upfront costs of expanding Medicaid. Incumbent Republican Governor Dennis Dugard says he worries about the state's share of Medicaid expansion. He says it rises quickly from $2 million next year to $10 million the year after. Dugard also disagrees that the only care 48,000 South Dakotans have is from the ER.
Nearly half today have private insurance or can get subsidized health insurance for as little as 2% of their income. Many of those could get that subsidy. They also have the ability to gain the subsidized insurance for working as little as 30 hours a week at the minimum wage.
Dugard says some people can currently get health coverage on a sliding scale through federal programs. Independent candidate Mike Myers says he supports expanding Medicaid in South Dakota. He's especially concerned about the state's elderly and wants to focus on supporting people as they age. Myers calls medicine an epidemic.
I'll take a look at the not-for-profit behavior of these systems where they advertise by the millions of dollars, pay their executives and doctors millions of dollars, and overtreat. Because remember, access saves, but access kills. And my model will be the establishment of a health care co-op.
Meyer says that plan puts South Dakotans in control and intends to reduce health insurance premiums. All three gubernatorial hopefuls say education is one of their priorities. Republican Governor Dennis Dugard says education gets the largest chunk of state dollars, and K-12 schools often receive any money left after South Dakota lawmakers fulfill other obligations of government. He says local schools get to choose how they use funding from the state.
Now, the National Education Association says we're 51st in pay for teachers. That same study also shows we're 39th in revenue per student. And the difference between 51st and 39th is how that money is spent at the local level. Local school boards determine how teachers are paid, not the state government.
Dugard says he supports South Dakota teachers, but he won't spend money the state doesn't have. Independent candidate Mike Myers says South Dakota leaders have to invest money in education, but he wants to make sure the state gets a return on those investments. Democratic State Representative Susan Wismer says rock-bottom teacher pay makes recruiting qualified teachers difficult for districts small and large.
The pipeline is empty. The free market works, and we shouldn't be surprised that it's worked in South Dakota. The first answer to correcting the problem is a change in the direction from the governor's office, a change in priorities, and a respect for education that we do not see coming now from the Capitol.
Wismer says South Dakota now has millions more in reserves than just 4 years ago. She says a real commitment to education takes those dollars out of the bank and infuses them into education. Candidates answered additional questions about government transparency, natural disaster support, economic development, and the state's activities connected to the federal EB-5 program. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Keely Bultina in Sioux Falls.
On Friday, About 200 people lined a busy street in Rapid City, held up their hands, and chanted words that have become a slogan in a national movement.
Don't shoot! Hands up! Don't shoot! Hands up! Don't shoot!
Organizers of this rally hoped it would open the door for new solutions to race issues and to help end future violent altercations with the police. Just over 24 hours later, Rapid City police were called to a home to remove an unwanted subject. Captain Dan Rood alleges the suspect, 30-year-old Alan Locke, a Lakota man, attacked Officer Anthony Myros with a knife. Myros then fired multiple shots, killing Locke.
The officer is white. The suspect is Native American. But it's not a race deal. This is based on criminal behavior and has nothing to do with race. If the police officer was Native American and the suspect was white, the result would have been the same thing.
Rood says the police had a history with Locke. County and state law enforcement are now investigating the incident and have taken testimony from witnesses for an official report. In the Lakota Homes neighborhood, local residents are grappling with the tragedy. Melanie Stoneman says Locke's children were in the home where the shooting occurred.
If you have a heart, you're going to cry with us. You're going to feel with us. You're going to understand.
Stoneman, a Sichangu Lakota, is a Rapid City resident on hand for a prayer service at the scene of the incident.
As is Indian people, that's our son. That's how we could say that's our son. And any mother would say that. Any mother's heart would hurt for another mother.
Stoneman says the police are not dealing properly with the deeper issues surrounding this tragedy. For Stoneman, this incident only contributes to a long-standing mistrust of police in this community.
And I would tell my son, if you're stopped by the police, take your hands out of your pocket, put your arms in the air, ask them not to shoot. Tell them you don't want to die, and do whatever they ask. These are the things that us mothers are having to teach our children to survive here on these streets when it comes to being pulled over. It's not appropriate for us to have to teach our children those kinds of tactics.
Many in the Native American community say they do not believe the criminal justice system treats them fairly. It's a perception that has been well documented in the past.
I want to thank you. I'm Mary Frances Berry, chairperson of the United States Commission on Civil Rights.
In 1999, the U.S. Civil Rights Commission came to South Dakota after a string of race-related deaths. In one case, a Lakota man in Mobridge died after being shoved into a garbage can. On Pine Ridge, two men were shot execution style and their bodies left near White Clay, Nebraska. And in Rapid City, a number of people were found dead in Rapid Creek. To this day, some of these deaths remain unsolved. The incident sparked protest and anger in the Native community. By the winter of 1999, the U.S. Civil Rights Commission took notice. They came to the Black Hills, heard testimony from about 100 people, and issued this report.
Native Americans in South Dakota, an erosion of confidence in the justice system.
Mark Feinstein was chair of the advisory committee to the commission.
There is a crisis in South Dakota today. Native Americans have lost confidence in the criminal justice system. There is a widespread perception that there is a dual system of justice, one for whites and another for Indians.
During this press conference 15 years ago, Commission Chair Mary Frances Berry went further.
Nothing is more corrosive to the legitimacy of democratic government than a widespread belief that justice is administered unfairly. The roots of Native American distrust of government lie deep and well entrenched, based on a legacy of mistreatment that is a shameful part of the American experience. The report makes clear that there are serious concerns about the administration of justice that must be addressed.
No, there's no change. There's no improvement whatsoever.
In 1999, Faith Takenalive testified before the U.S. Civil Rights Commission. 15 years later, she's frustrated at what she calls a lack of progress. Today, Takenalive lives in Mobridge and works as a paralegal for two tribal courts. She says Native people still confront racism in South Dakota on a daily basis.
You see them sitting in church every Sunday, and yet they turn around out of church and they hate their fellow man, people of color. How do you justify that? Where's the rationale?
This is SDPB Radio News. I'm Gary Lindbolt. The flu season is just getting started in South Dakota, but this year an unpredicted strain of flu is hitting hard in some areas of the country. State epidemiologist Lon Keitlinger says the H3 strain has been around for 46 years, but health officials never know when it's going to show up.
When H3 hits, it makes a lot of elderly people sick. It makes a lot of elderly people, it sends them to the hospital, and it also causes death in a lot of elderly people, too. So we're kind of bracing here for maybe a severe influenza year. You know, we don't know exactly until we're in the middle of it, but how it looks now, it could be treacherous.
Keitlinger says the H3 strain is not covered in this year's vaccine, but he says it's still important to get the flu shot to protect yourself from other flu strains that are also making an appearance in South Dakota. He also urges people who are sick to stay home and rest and not spread germs. A Pierre man convicted of second-degree murder and the death of a school classmate is set to be sentenced today. 18-year-old Braden McCarron was 16 when he shot and killed 16-year-old Dalton Williams in December of 2012. McCarron was tried as an adult. The jury did not convict McCarron of first-degree murder or of attempted murder and a threat against a second classmate, but jurors opted for a second-degree murder conviction. Last month, Judge John Brown rejected a defense motion to set aside the jury verdict. McCarron's defense attorney, who says he wasn't given a chance to prepare a defense for second-degree murder, says he will appeal the conviction to the state Supreme Court. The mandatory sentence for second-degree murder is life in prison. Since McCarron was a juvenile at the time of the killing, he could receive a lesser sentence and be eligible for parole. A 45-foot-tall statue of a Native woman is planned for the Missouri River at Chamberlain. The statue, titled Dignity, depicts a Lakota woman receiving a star quilt. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Charles Michael Ray reports.
Black Hills sculptor Dale Lamphere is commissioned to complete the giant statue on the eastern bluff of the Missouri River. Lamphere says the piece depicts a Lakota woman wrapping a star quilt around her shoulders. In Lakota culture, star quilts are given as a sign of honor and respect.
And what you'll see when you first go by on the interstate will be this upward sweeping triangular form of a star quilt. And I plan to cut through the metal and back it with color and then have interior lighting.
Lanfear is working with landscape architect Pat Wiss on placement and lighting of the statue. Lakota artist David Claymore is a silversmith who's also collaborating on the piece.
I've talked to my people over the last couple of weeks and working on this star quilt pattern. Well, what do you think of this idea? And they all said, wow. You know, it's like South Dakota's recognizing the beauty that we are.
A $1 million donation from the McKee family of Rapid City is funding the project. Officials say they expect the monument to be constructed and installed in 2015. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Charles Michael Ray in Rapid City.
And the girlfriend of a Sioux Falls drug dealer who was killed in a robbery attempt has pleaded not guilty to state charges in his death. 21-year-old Faith Rasmussen is accused of burglary, attempted robbery, and solicitation to commit a felony. The indictment accuses Rasmussen of helping to plan the robbery that led to the shooting death of Jordan LeBeau. Court records show Rasmussen was dating LeBeau and supplying him with drugs at the time she asked two people to rob him. Authorities say the shooting took place after LeBeau's father walked in on the two teens beating his son during the attempted robbery. Last week, Rasmussen was sentenced to nearly 7 years in federal prison on charges of drug trafficking and money laundering. Here and Now is coming up next for SDPB Radio News. I'm Gary Lindbolt.